I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now, the definition.
So, the United States of America currently does not have a Speaker of the House. This is the first time in American history that a Speaker has been deposed, vacated, kicked out, whatever you want to call it. But that happened today, and it was quite shocking. It was very dramatic. And one of the first questions here is, can someone explain this to me like I'm 5 years old? Happy to. So, in order to become Speaker, when you're first elected, you have to win a majority of the House of Representatives. A majority of representatives have to elect you as Speaker. Now, usually what happens is that one party wins the election, and you get a majority in the House. And depending on how large that majority is, the people in that party, you know, if Republicans win the election, Republicans select their Speaker. If Democrats win the election, Democrats win their Speaker. Now, in the last two Congresses, we have had historically small margins. So the Republicans have the majority by 2, 3, 4, only 5 votes out of 435. Democrats similarly had a similar margin as well, very, very narrow. And so the more narrow your margin is, the more you need your entire party to come together to select that Speaker, or really to get anything done. That's why earlier this year, we saw all those memes, all those jokes, you know, whatever, about Kevin McCarthy and this long saga to become Speaker of the House, because Republicans had the smallest majority, smallest margin, about 5. You know, it's give or take, because sometimes there's a resignation or a vacancy or a death, but it's roughly 5. Sometimes even smaller. And so they basically needed everybody, and they could only lose less than 5 votes. Sometimes when House Democrats have a very large majority, if you have a majority that's up by 35, you can lose 20 votes. But in slim majorities, everyone in your party basically needs to vote the same way in order for your party to secure the speakership. So Kevin McCarthy, at the beginning of this term, was in that situation. And the way that he has handled that situation, he basically gave away the farm. He made all of these promises to all of these people, many of which were either incompatible or tangled, and it makes it very difficult for you to lead when you make so many promises and you have to uphold them. Then they are contradictory, and it's very difficult for you to govern after doing that. And that's the position that Kevin McCarthy was in. One of the concessions that he gave to his extreme right wing was something known as a one-person motion to vacate, where at any point, just one out of the over 200 members of his party could file a motion to vacate, which means that they could file a motion to kick him out, could call to kick him out at any point in time. Just one. Not 5, not 10, not a critical mass calling for your resignation. You just needed one. So that has meant that for the last 9 months, Kevin McCarthy signed up to be held hostage. And he has been held hostage. Anytime one of the most extreme members of the Republican Party wanted something, they would threaten Kevin McCarthy with this motion to vacate. And as a result, well, maybe not just solely as a result of that, but as a major part of that has meant that McCarthy has governed in very extreme, bizarre ways over the last 9 months, just yielding all of this power to an extreme right wing. And all of that came to a head, basically, with the government shutdown. This extreme right wing wanted to make sure that, you know, in order to avoid a government shutdown, you have to fund the government. They wanted to fund the government in their way prescriptively. They wanted to fund their government at their levels. They wanted to fund the government using their processes. Except the problem is that House Republicans only have barely a majority of the House of Representatives, but we have a Democratic Senate, thanks to people like you who turned out to vote in critical states. We have a Democratic Senate and we have a Democratic president. And so if you're a Republican and you are that outgunned that way, you can't force through whatever you want. Joe Biden is not going to sign Marjorie Taylor Greene's little harebrained ideas. It's just not going to happen. Not going to, you know, a Democratic Senate led by Chuck Schumer is not going to agree to this nonsense that that these extremists want. But regardless, they were forcing Kevin McCarthy's hand anyway. And what happened is that when we avoided a government shutdown on Saturday, we did so with something known as a clean CR. We gave ourselves a 45-day extension. Well, that made these Republicans really mad. In fact, that extension was passed with more Democratic votes than Republican votes, which is almost which is actually quite rare. So what they decided to do was that a couple of things happened. First of all, Kevin McCarthy, we were supposed to be in recess this week. It was Kevin McCarthy that decided to take us out of recess, the House out of recess, and right back into work. I'm supposed to be in New York. I was supposed to be in community this week. We're supposed to be with folks that were affected by flooding, but Kevin McCarthy decided we're gonna be back in the House this week. To do what? I don't even know. This, apparently. And what happened last night was that Matt Gaetz immediately filed a motion to vacate. And like I said, it just takes one member, one upset member, to file that motion to vacate. And when you file that motion to vacate, you get 48 hours before the vote must occur. You get 48 hours before that vote has to happen. And so he filed it last night. And for reasons that I do not have insight into, Kevin McCarthy decided that he was not going to wait. He was going to call that vote right away. Call that vote right away. And it seems as though that Republicans and Kevin McCarthy was under the impression that Democrats were going to elect a Republican speaker somehow. Why he thought that, I do not know. Why he made that assumption, I'm not quite sure. Perhaps it is because a Democratic Party in the past, maybe a Democratic Party in the 90s, would have been able to work more with Republicans. That was a different world. And today is a new day where there are fascists in the Republican Party that represent a very real threat to American democracy. And I don't think that I, nor many other people, are very interested in empowering a dynamic that has been very destructive and also an active participant in events like January 6th. On top of that, Kevin McCarthy somehow expected Democrats, I guess, shockingly, to bail him out on this when he has repeatedly made deals with Democrats that he has gone back on, when he's made promises that he continues to break. And so at a certain point, people can say, you know, there's all these cliches about politicians and like all this other stuff, but there really is something to be said that in governance, your word is your bond. You cannot break promises over and over again with people that you work with. It's just not going to happen, especially when you need to rely on those people to cut a deal in such a tight margin. And so when you vote to overturn election results, when you cut a deal with the president and Leader Schumer and Leader Jeffries to raise the debt limit, and then you say, never mind. When you say, I will not allow a sham and baseless impeachment inquiry to go forward, the only way that I would allow it to go forward is if the majority of the House of Representatives votes to open it, and then you say, never mind. When you rely on Democratic votes to keep the government open on Saturday, and then on Sunday you wake up and you tell everybody they voted to shut down the government, and your word is your bond, and when you show that your word means nothing, then your bond means nothing. The thing about Washington and the thing about governance, and I think just the thing about trust in general, is that, you know, we try to secure things as much as humanly possible. They say, okay, you want to give me this for that or whatever, you want to strike a deal. You know, the bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, right? But usually the way that things work is that there's some kind of sequence, and invariably, inevitably, there comes a point where you actually do just have to trust that that other person is going to do what they say they're going to do. That sometimes you can't secure everything 100,000%, even just in terms of house rules. Like if I say I will vote on this, or I'm open to discussing that, if we can bring up this issue next week, or if we can vote on that next week, that those kinds of conversations happen all the time. And whether you like it or not, or this, that, the other, that's part of how governance works in a diverse nation that elects 435 different elected representatives who all negotiate different priorities. And if you do that, there's always invariably a point where someone has to commit first, and they put their trust in that other person who says, I got you next week at this point, whatever. And when you go out on that limb for that person, and then that person thanks you by not doing what they said they're going to do, you end up in this situation. It's not just with Democrats, it's with many people in his own party. You don't end up in this situation without some sort of personal responsibility. He was the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, third in line to the presidency. And this is a serious matter that, and a serious responsibility that actually does transcend party. It does transcend party. Once you are Speaker of the House, you are responsible for the entire country. You are third in line to the presidency. You are, of course, very responsible to your party, the party that elected you. But you steward over the entire chamber. And when you burn half of that chamber, scorched earth, when you erode the institution, when you censure and remove Democrats from committees over complete partisan nonsense, over some Fox News conspiracy, not even as good as a Fox News conspiracy theory, but when you start stripping Democrats from committees, when you defend members that have been indicted on 13 federal charges, like George Santos has, from wire fraud to lying to members of Congress, when you defend your own members who have threatened the lives of other members, sharing violent depictions of murder of other members of Congress, and you stand up and you say, that's okay with me, that bill starts to rack up real fast. It starts to rack up real fast. And on top of it all, what blows my mind is the fact that apparently this guy and a lot of Republicans, from their statements, somehow felt entitled to Democrats bailing them out, or somehow felt like Democrats were going to vote for them in some way, shape, or form without even asking for it. Without even asking for it. It's not like people said, yeah, like I 100% got you on this specific vote tomorrow. They did not work it. They did not call. They did not try to deal. In fact, they played in everyone's face. And then they expected, after playing in everybody's face, that we were somehow going to vote to maintain this speakership. It is astonishing to me that an individual elected to become Speaker of the House somehow was engaged in so much magical thinking around vote counts and around how this institution can remain together. And I think, you know, this moment is not good. I want to be clear about that. I don't think it's cute or funny, but I also think that actions have consequences. And if we do not follow through on the natural consequences of reckless behavior, then we enable that behavior. A vote for Kevin McCarthy would have meant a continued vote for the enabling of the most extreme elements of the Republican Party, period.
Brian Kilmeade, he seems to be a little bit more invested in this.
They have thrown Kevin McCarthy overboard. Our next guest is one of those GOP members who voted to oust Kevin McCarthy. Congressman Tim Burchett joins us now. Congressman, you were one of the eight. So Speaker McCarthy had 96% approval rating, but that wasn't good enough for you. Do you feel good about your vote?
I don't know about 96%.
Well, they voted for
the people. Well, I don't work for the people in Congress. I work for the people of the 2nd District of Tennessee. And overwhelmingly, the folks are tired of the fact that we take in $5 trillion and we spend $7 trillion, that your leadership continues to pass these continuation resolutions. They push us right up against a holiday. Well, guess what? The 45-day one is pushed right up against it. We took off 6 weeks this summer from August to... We usually just take off August, but they decided to take over 2 more weeks. And I feel like that's a failure of leadership. They're the ones who set the schedule.
So,
he's the speaker.
Right.
Ultimately, the buck stops somewhere, and diverting the attention somewhere else, I think, is just wrong.
So you realize this is the first time in history that this has been done. So you're upset about 6 weeks in the summer. Did you call him during the summer can we get back to work?
I'm also upset at the fact we're $33 trillion in debt.
Is that Kevin McCarthy's fault?
It could be. He needs to accept some responsibility.
Didn't he have an 8% cut offered over that in that continuing resolution bill?
And the rate of growth, but you're not looking at the $33 trillion. And that's really just peanuts compared to the $33 trillion that we've run up. You know, we continue. If you look at the bills that we did pass, the appropriations, the one that had the cut was the agriculture bill, and it didn't pass because the Republicans sided with Democrats. But yet the defense bill, which had... Wait a minute. The defense bill that had $30 billion new dollars in the Pentagon, which has never passed an audit, which has lost at one time 60% of their assets. We reward them with $30 billion more dollars for the war pimps at the Pentagon can spread more war around the globe.
So because he didn't audit the Pentagon and get every appropriation bill done, you're going to make history by ousting him to move your agenda forward. Here's what Kevin McCarthy said about you.
I personally like Tim Burchett, and I called Tim Burchett because I read his quote. And Tim Burchett's a friend of mine, which I'm kind of shocked by this. And Tim Burchett, in his quote, said, he's leaning towards no, he's on CNN, but I'm going to pray about it. So I pick up the phone and call him, because I didn't think he was already there. I said, Tim, I read your quote. You said you're going to pray about it. I want to talk to you about it. And somehow he construes that I'm a Christian. I'm not going to offend somebody. I simply read his quote back. I thought there was still an opening, and I wanted to talk to him about it. He never mentioned anything when we were communicating like that.
So you said part of the reason you voted like that is because you felt he was mocking you, correct? So it's personal.
And that's not accurate, and that's any of that. I asked him about the 6 weeks off. I asked him about why we didn't have a term limits bill up and continued on down the line, and it was always not his fault. You know, leadership has responsibilities. The buck stops.
Sorry, the amount of asks here. Can we narrow it down a little bit? I understand, I'm even sympathetic to wanting to audit the Pentagon.
Yep.
But maybe let's not throw term limits also in there, a giant wish list of all of the dumb crap we want.
But part of it is that McCarthy gave them these promises. Part of it, look, they're not good faith actors. I understand that. But to get to power, he promised everything to everybody. And that's why there were insane expectations, because these people aren't also the brightest bulbs in the fixture. And there's a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. Well, and none of that crap is going to happen.
That's the other thing, is that it's so sort of laughable about this, is that all of that is performative. It's all performative. There's going to be cuts to the budget, not the military budget probably, but there's going to be cuts to the budget when you have split government. But all the other things he's talking about are complete non-starters, and he must know that. And it's one thing to get out there and try and convince people, we need to do this. It's another to try and get out there and convince people that you can do it when you have split government. And it's hilarious.
And to do to get into power. That's the thing that is just so amazing about it, is that McCarthy really did make his own bed here.
Oh, yeah. It's hard for me to express how much I'm enjoying both these people eat each other's face.
I love it.
Where, and in the House of Representatives, it stops and starts at the Speaker's office, and clearly that's not happening. And clearly, you want to continue to make excuses for him, but the truth is his approval rating around the country was not very high. And I don't represent the people of Congress.
Right,
I represent the people in Tennessee.
I got it. What do you think is going to do for the Republican Party and chances of holding on to leadership and the majority when it looks like you're the ringleader of a circus led by Matt Gaetz, who likes to blow things up, but not offer any new ideas? Are you happy following Matt Gaetz? Is that your leader?
I'm not following Matt Gaetz. I made my own decision. I didn't ask Matt.
But if Matt Gaetz didn't
approval,
challenge, you weren't going to challenge.
Do what?
If Matt Gaetz didn't stand up, you weren't going to challenge. You know that.
I believe I would have.
Oh, come on.
Please.
You were praying about it 1 minute. The next minute, you're going to lead an insurgency?
So you don't think that praying about it's important? Is that what you're saying?
You're praying about how you're going to vote with Matt Gaetz. And the next minute, you're going to lead an insurgency?
Listen, you got a predetermined answer to everything.
I have an opinion about what's going on. Do you have an opinion, too?
And you talk over me every time I try to make a point.
All right, make your point.
The point is that we're $33 trillion in debt. This speaker was woefully, woefully lacking in leadership skills. He always placed the blame somewhere else. America is going to be better off with new leadership. And
right.
That's the bottom line.
And who is it?
Possibly it could be Steve Scalise. It could be Elise Stefanik. It could be Roger Williams out of Texas. It could be Mark Green out of Tennessee.
So they all supported Kevin McCarthy, including the most conservative guy I know, Jim Jordan. Why are you smarter than Jim Jordan and the 210 plus Republicans? Why are you smarter?
I represent my district, brother. And why are you smarter than me? You're condemning me because I stand up on my own, and that's what
I'm not condemning you. I'm questioning you. You don't like being questioned?
You're the line of questioning is very negative, and you know that, and I know that. When this is all over with, and we have a new speaker, and we're running smooth, let's have this conversation again.
So were you happy with John
When's
Boehner?
That gonna be?
I wasn't here with John Boehner.
Right. Paul Ryan?
They're both rhinos. I mean, why do you? They're not in my camp anyway. So I wasn't here when they were here.
So you had 15 yeses for every round you voted for Kevin McCarthy, but you think he's the problem.
Right now, I sure do. He's part of it. He's part of this whole problem. When you deny that there's a problem, in this dysfunctional Washington, brother, then you know there's a problem. You can't
who
get past
the problem.
You can't get past the fact we take in $5 trillion, we spend $7 trillion, and leadership seems to be okay
with
that.
I'm fascinated the way you blame Kevin McCarthy that you're $33 trillion in debt, but you're going to get a new leader. I'm sure he's going to solve everything.
Well, I'm surprised that you give him full credit for all the successes that we've had.
I don't think you should take all the blame.
Well, why are we backing it up? We had 9 months exactly. That's a great point. Why do we wait 9 months to do something about the wall, something about the budget, something about, well, we never did anything about term limits.
Well, for 15 minutes, he was doing an awful lot, but not enough for you. Tim Burchett, Congressman, thanks so much.
If there was a way to fill a bathtub with that, I would take a bath in that for weeks.
An injection of that into my veins.
Right. Sam wants to chug that.
I mean, I don't know if that guy Burchett is sincere about his positions, but like, is he aware of what the Republican Party has been doing for the past, I don't know, forever? I mean, it's just fascinating. It really is just fascinating. And, you know, of course, Kilmeade is pissed because he spent years and years probably building up this relationship with Kevin McCarthy and people around him. And all of that is going away.
Kevin McCarthy has. Yeah, exactly. Kevin McCarthy has made friends with a lot of the Fox News hosts. They came out in the Tucker Carlson text, right? Was that the Dominion suit? You know what I'm about to say, right? They were joking about how Maria Bartiromo and Kevin McCarthy were dating because they were so close together. Right. And
he was on Fox and Friends too all the time.
That was Kevin McCarthy's superpower, was his ability, and the superpower, that's way too, giving him way too
but
much
that's
credit.
His thing, the glad
but that
hand
was
hand
his
hand.
Thing, his glad, and he was somebody who made relationships. I was listening to CNN after this happened, and they talked about how he just, with basically every member of the caucus, would say, you know, just be my friend, and then he would hand them a check for $5,000 when they entered Congress, and said, like, use this for your re-election bid and stuff. So he did favors for people, but the Matt Gaetz was like, I don't really care about those incentives. I'm outside of that. And he got enough people to come along with him on that fight.
You've read the title. You've seen the thumbnail. You've inspected the element and combed through the metadata. This episode is about moderates, centrists, independents, pragmatists, middle grounders, fence straddlers, and the ungodly, unceremonious, electable politician. Today, we're looking at everyone's political neighbors in the middle of the street. Let's get this started. Cue the MLK.
First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice.
Look, I already know what you're going to say. JT, please describe to me in political science terms what a moderate is. Fine. But only because I want to. And as punishment for being so presumptuous, I'll start with the difference between the left and the right. You probably already know the story of the two terms. During the French Revolution, those who wanted to laisser les bons temps brûler with absolute monarchical power sat on the right side of the assembly, their version of the house, and the no-good radicals who wanted to try out terrifying and capricious parliamentary monarchy, sat on the left. This is a pretty specific issue to disagree about. So when people, i.e. academics with too much free time, try to come up with meaningful differences between the left and the right that hold true across most of global political history, you get very vague distinctions between the two political families. While today we associate the left and the right mostly with their stances on specific economic issues or cultural debates, the most fundamental distinction that you can probably draw between these two is that the left seeks to change society into something new, and the right seeks to preserve present society or go back to something old. In practice, that usually means the left seeks to undermine established hierarchies and distribute power and wealth more equally, and the right seeks to preserve hierarchy and order since most existing societies are or were built around power being concentrated in very few hands. But obviously, such a simple distinction will certainly make you mad. So be sure to comment why and how I've actually gotten it completely wrong in the comment section. I sure would hate for this video to get more engagement. Anyway, we've lost the plot a little bit here. We're not focusing on either of these groups. We're talking about the illuminated minds who can look past the squabbling of these dirty extremes. Moderates. The people who reject petty ideological battles, and at the end of the day, just know better than you and I. Just listen to how terrible the extremes are in this No Labels video on the Biden infrastructure bill.
We've seen this movie before.
Total?
No, not those movies. This one.
We will not support bipartisan legislation.
I'm telling the Republican senator that we're not going to stand for it.
The extremes on the left and right are trying to defeat a two-party solution for partisan purposes. 3 out of 4 Americans agree on the infrastructure bill that creates jobs, helps families, doesn't raise taxes, and powers America to beat China. Don't listen to the extremes. Support bipartisan infrastructure now.
Cool. Okay, fine. Let's be a little bit more charitable and actually understand what's going on here. Centrists and moderates in the US, the two terms are pretty much interchangeable, are people and politicians who are not entirely satisfied with the political programs of either major political party. Unlike people who reject both parties from the opposite ends of the spectrum, moderates are most at home in the supposed bipartisan middle. They usually like saying things like, "We're neither left nor right." We'll get to that sentence in a minute. But first, we might want to understand centrists a little better. If we are to assume the definition of left and right as historically transcendent terms about the stance one has towards present society and values like egalitarianism, being a centrist doesn't really make sense. Over time, movements that start out on the left, like liberalism, republicanism, or even parliamentary monarchy, become solidly right-wing movements without ever changing their ideology because they replace the old right and become contested by the new, more radical left. In such a position, centrism becomes nothing more than a conservative ideology. Its prime directive is resistance to change, and as a result, it's not, as they claim, neither left nor right, it's just right wing. It might have been on the left in yesterday's society, but now that the goals of the old left are the established order and have become the new conservative right, preserving present society with only incremental and moderate reform, which is what centrists believe in, becomes a profoundly conservative worldview. And it makes sense that this is where moderacy settles, because it has to compromise between two completely opposing ideas: changing society in a new way, or keeping it the same. Think about classic centrist statements like, "We just need a mix of socialism and capitalism," an idea that makes absolutely zero sense when you understand the two ideologies and that their base disagreement about the ownership of the means of production makes them fundamentally incompatible. Okay, this all might seem a little confusing. Let's get away from the theory for a second and look at something concrete, like the Biden brand of centrism.
I know how to make government work. Not because I talked or tweeted about it, but because I've done it. I've worked across the aisle to reach consensus, to help make government work in the past. I can do that again with your help. Never be compromised, but compromise itself is not a dirty word. Consensus is not a weakness. It's the only way our founders down the road there thought it was the only way we could govern. It was necessary. It was designed the way the Constitution sits. It requires consensus.
This speech is Biden's free bird. Biden, like pretty much every centrist, is a big fan of compromise. Reaching across the aisle to get past political gridlock is the doctrine of American centrism. And when you hear him talk about it, you can kind of get sucked into the idea that this form of compromise is what makes politics, and therefore society, progress. It appeals to our vision of the democratic ideal, a society in which everyone gathers around the table to discuss an issue and then comes to a mutual decision that compromises on the various interests represented by the assembly. And if, after all, nobody compromises, we might very well not get anywhere. In American politics, this is anything but democratic, though. And far from leading to the progress we're promised, we get a government that stagnates or actively pursues regressive, reactionary politics. Take immigration. For over a year, we heard just about every Democrat call out the very real far-right policies enacted by the Trump admin at the Mexican border. One of these was the invocation of Title 42, a policy choice that might as well be called, oh, it really is just that easy. At the start of the pandemic, the Trump administration used the pretext of national health and COVID-19 to close the southern border pretty much completely. Nobody comes in, and a whole lot of people go out. It was a brilliant success for conservatives and reactionaries, and a massive step back in immigration law. And to this day, Title 42 still stands. No, sorry, that makes it seem like people aren't paying attention to it. The Biden administration is defending it tooth and nail in the courts. True to the spirit of compromise, Biden changed the application of the rule so that it would no longer apply to unaccompanied minors, but on the back end has used it to expel around 700,000 migrants, far more than the Trump administration ever achieved with its paltry 450,000. Simultaneously, Biden has also continued the construction of the border wall, has led the infamous Do Not Come campaign, and left untouched migrant detention facilities. You'll remember them as concentration camps during the Trump presidency. Now, it's not that Biden has done nothing for progressive immigration politics. He's reinstated DACA and done work to reunite separated families. But the majority of his platform has been tweaking Trump-era policies in the spirit of compromise, rather than reversing them entirely and treating them like the indefensible right-wing policies that they are. Centrism isn't incremental progress in these circumstances. Malcolm X said it best.
You feel, however, that we're making progress in this country and worldwide?
No. I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that the blow made. Won't even admit the knife is there.
When reactionary and far-right politics are so dominant in a society as the U.S., and so regularly find their way to institutions of power, or are baked in right from the start, the centrist stance of compromise and incremental retroactive change allows for politics to jump to the right without ever really coming back. How many politicians today pretend that there's a reasonable compromise between the "we need healthcare" left and the "we need an ethno-state" right? Title 42 still stands because the myopic compromise of moderate ideology fails to take into account longer political trends. There are, of course, some exceptions to the rightward shift of American politics, but the attachment to moderation at all costs makes any left-wing legislation a blip in what is otherwise a sea of reactionary bravado. But most centrists don't like this, and that's not how they think about themselves. They don't like the idea that they're just a mushy average of the left and the right, or a simple tool of conservative politics. Instead, moderates describe their stance something like this. I don't care whether something comes from the left or the right. I just look at the idea and judge it on its own merit. Here, the tricky centrist thinks he's gotten us. We couldn't possibly disagree with the idea of sensibly considering multiple options and forming an opinion based on rational cost and benefit analyses. And he's right, but at the end of the day, centrism falls right back into the same place whether it sees its role as averaging out the left and the right, or picking and choosing from each side. And that's because the Overton window is so small and so skewed in the US. The choices centrists make are limited by the acceptable politics they are contextualized in, and the American political spectrum being so stunted toward the right with only figures like Bernie Sanders and his social democratic politics even approaching the left means that centrism will by default fall into the conservative, stagnatory, or even regressive role. There just aren't that many options to choose from, and they're mostly on the same side anyway. even if the centrist voter is a careful and considerate pragmatist who doesn't blindly follow the party line and thinks entirely for themselves on every topic and political debate, the inevitable fact that they will be picking and choosing policies from the fascistic Trumpism in the Republican Party and the neoliberal capitalism of the Democrats, to the extent that they can even be differentiated at times, means they'll never actually consider the full range of political debate because the left isn't prominently represented. The result is the center conserves far more than it progresses. And when it chooses to conserve something built by the right, it actively engages in regressive, reactionary politics. There's also the issue that politicians who call themselves the center aren't really doing so in good faith. While they may represent the center between elected officials, the actual center of the American people is far more to the left on many key issues than the center of the American political class. Just look at this clip featuring celebrity centrist Joe Lieberman.
Your new book is called The Centrist Solution. You were a famous quote-unquote centrist senator. And yet my issue with that word is that centrist doesn't necessarily reflect the American people's views. I want to pull up some polling. Here are some of the measures in that Build Back Better bill that quote-unquote centrists like Manchin and Sinema want to get rid of. Here's how popular they are. Hugely popular across the spectrum. 83% support, 84% support, 73% support. And yet you and Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema oppose many of those measures that the American people overwhelmingly support. So the question is, how in the world does that make you a centrist? Surely based on that polling, Bernie Sanders is closer to the center of American politics and public opinion than you are or Joe Manchin is.
Yeah, I don't think so, but it's a great question. That's not happening enough now. We could probably get some of those good things done on that list if people, instead of trying to push it through, would sit down and talk to each other and agree.
And here we get back to that MLK quote. It's absurd to think that any moderate Democrat or any Republican would ever agree to any of these policies that have overwhelming support among Americans if the only difference was that they were sat down and talked to, as opposed to having things, quote, pushed through. There is no way that moderate Democrats like Manchin, Sinema, or Biden are going to be convinced by good argumentation presented politely when that is contending with the massive sums of money changing hands to make sure they remain spoilers. MLK made it very clear. The moderates' role in politics is to slow things down to a trickle. Justice gets delayed further and further, never actually realized despite decades of promises, allowing for millions of people to continue suffering injustice and hundreds of thousands more to be brought into the fold. It's trite, but justice delayed is justice denied. The issue we're going to have to figure out is how we do anything about this. In every election, moderates are going to dominate the field because they will continuously be presented as more sensible, measured, and pragmatic than their opponents. They have done the careful electoral calculation and know that between the people who will inevitably vote for them and the people who will never vote for them regardless of what they do, the only way to win is to present themselves to the colossal group of American moderates who won't bother to go any further than see who gets closest to being the exact average of the Democrats and the Republicans. We know Americans want more from their politicians. We know that, for the greatest number of them, those things are further to the left than anything the government has provided in decades. That is a much bigger issue for our democracy than polarization. Democracy is slow by nature, and there are times when that can be a good thing. But when democracy is slowed down artificially like this, just for the sake of slowing it down and not letting things change for the better, when politicians ignore what people not only demand, but desperately need, it no longer resembles democracy nor its ideals. If you're hearing an appeal to authoritarianism or something in these statements, you're not understanding what I'm saying. We need far greater democracy than what we have today. Real democracy. Democracy for the majority. And continuing to venerate moderates in this country won't bring us any closer to getting it.
Storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
about me. I don't want myself on your mind if you're not going to work for the people.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Miami Adiso Gaya. And welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast episode segment, because this is just an episode segment. I mean, I think this is part three, basically. I may make it technically the second part and put the first one that I recorded as a third part, because to me that one's the weakest out of the three, which probably means it should be first. But you know something? You don't want to hear all that. So, welcome. Still talking about McCarthy. So I want to actually begin by discussing something that Stuart Stevens said on Lawrence O'Donnell's show. He said that this generation of conservatives were the they were the recipients of the fruits of the labors of the greatest generation, who had fought fascism and autocracy and had defeated it. I am not a big fan, I've made this statement before actually, I'm not a big fan of calling that generation the greatest generation, because what that essentially says is, one, every generation before it was trash and every generation after it progressively gets worse. I'm not a fan of Brokaw calling that generation the greatest generation. Not simply because, you know, I don't like that generation. No. It's because, well, one, the generation did not fight and defeat fascism or autocracy. What do I mean? That generation was fine with fascism and autocracy. They had no problem with Jim Crow. They had no problem with apartheid, which, contrary to popular beliefs, was not just a southern thing in the United States. It was all over the country. They had no problem with renegade governments in the South that were autocratic. They had no problem with autocratic social organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, who were also fascist. They had no problem with none of that. They just had a problem with how it was being dispatched overseas. They had a problem with how it was being dispatched overseas. That's it. If Hitler had not decided to go and systematically annihilate the Jews, and if he had just stopped with a few countries, and maybe taking a couple of bites out of Russia, nobody would have really cared. It would have just been, well, that's some imperial stuff that the Germans do periodically. Who cares? We can still work with them. They didn't care. It was that he went overboard with killing the Jews. That's what made it a non-starter. They wanted to, a lot of them wanted to work with the fascists. Not only wanted to work with the fascists, but wanted to get pointers with how to deal with the left in the United States from the fascists. And they wanted to implement, if not totally, some parts of autocracy further here in the United States. Even though, as I stated before, just look at the Jim Crow South and you'll see a lot of autocracy. They were not the greatest generation. And in fact, that's not really a knock on them. The realities of the time were birthed from the realities of the post-Civil War United States economy. For all the talk of how great the United States is and was, the fact is, and I've said this many times, in the late 1800s, the United States loved fascism. It just didn't call it that. Corporations' ability to control the federal government and to control the everyday lives of the citizens was just normal. I mean, yeah, sure, people fought against it, but if they got too rowdy, they'd call in the military, who would suppress them and put them down. You know, that was before civilian military forces were developed. I mean, police departments, as they are called today. But it was a reality. And that reality didn't change from 1880 to 1930. It just transformed. It was called something different. But it was what it was. This should help you understand how unique, and I've said this before, and it really needs to be repeated here, how unique 1950s through really the early part of the 2000s was in American history. You're talking about a near 60-year period of time that did not mirror the previous 60 years or the 60 years before that. Now, of course, you'd say, well, of course it didn't. I mean, of course it wouldn't mirror it. What are you talking about, Ogaya? The history changed too much. The political structure I'm talking about, the political economy structure is what I'm talking about. It changed so drastically. It changed so drastically. Now, part of that had to do with Keynes and his theories. The man wrote a lot of books, by the way. It's kind of interesting. People talk a lot about Wealth of Nations and things like that, but Keynes wrote some work. He wrote some work, but you know, it had a bit to do with him, but it also had to do with the engagement of the average American citizen with the federal government and telling the federal government that it needed to do more to take control of the economic factors that were crushing the average American citizen. I mean, truthfully, understanding that economic transformation is key to understanding the New Deal and why the New Deal was more than just the programs that FDR implemented for the brief moment in the 1930s. But I actually recorded an episode about that, which you will be getting soon, actually, because I was working on it when McCarthy was kicked out of the speakership. So you will be getting that soon. I'm actually done with it. I just have to write up the description and release it. I might actually release it with this one. Well, we'll see. Anyway, I wanted to start off talking about that point, because it is really a knock on the potential within that generation and the potential in preceding generations. That generation did the best that it could with what it had, but it wasn't a revolutionary generation. It wasn't even close to that. The 60s generation was far more revolutionary than they were. Now, what Stuart Stevens did say, and he's right, I've made this argument on this podcast, neoconservatives were absolutely 100% the benefactors of the World War II generation. Can't argue with that. That's the truth. And there's probably a psychological history that needs to be written examining what exactly was given in that transgenerational endowment from one generation to another. But I don't want to spend too much time on that because this is really still about McCarthy. Big shout out to the Professional Left podcast, who I was really looking forward to hearing, you know, what they had to say about it. So, obviously, one of the arguments that many of you have probably heard attached to this McCarthy speakership debacle, or depantsing, or I don't know, what should we call it? this McCarthy speakership smackdown, removal, well, removal is correct, but it seems so insignificant. Anyway, one of the things you probably heard is that this is the Democrats' fault. The Democrats actually removed him. No, they didn't. No, they really didn't. And obviously people have said this, but they didn't. They were under no obligation to actually vote for this man. In fact, it's logical that they would vote for Hakeem Jeffries, who I'm not a big fan of, but it is logical that they would vote for somebody in their own group. It's only logical. Many Republicans have said that the Democratic Party should have voted to keep McCarthy as Speaker because that would have put the country first. These same Republicans do not ever put the country first. Ever put the country first. When the Democrats are trying to do something that not only is going to benefit the Democratic politician and the people within their district, but will benefit the Republicans and the people in their districts who are opposing it. We saw this in action, 2 years ago? With the infrastructure bill. All the Republicans voted against it. And yet, all the Republicans have run ads proclaiming that they brought monies procured in that bill that they voted against. They have brought that money to their districts to rebuild infrastructure when none of them actually voted for that bill. When is it going to be time that these spineless serpents are asked to put the country first? Wait, you called them serpents. I mean, are you saying they're animals? In the black community, we know what a serpent is. It's a metaphor for something. I don't have to call them animals. They either act animalish or they don't. But to call a person a serpent isn't to say that they're an animal. It's to say something else. These people are always making demands on the Democrats, on progressives, on anybody that's not themselves. They are always making demands that that folks who they view as un-American should always put America first by supporting any crazy thing that they want to pass. They never say to themselves, I'm going to put America first by signing on to legislation that's going to positively impact people within my congressional district, but just so happens to be put forward by a Democrat because nobody in the Republican Party will put it forward because they're too afraid that the moneyed men who are actually backing them up won't continue to back them up. They themselves never say, I'm going to put the United States first. I'm going to put Americans first. They say, no, I'm going to put myself first. I'm going to put my wallet first. I'm going to put my rich benefactors first. To hell with the country. Every time when these people say, God bless America, what they're really saying is, God damn America. Oh, yes, they do. Oh, no, that was Reverend Wright. He said that. Oh, yes, Reverend Wright said it. But see, he was actually man enough, and he had the cojones enough to actually say it. Your actions tell me that you believe it. You just don't have the cojones to say it. You act in a way which destroys the things that America needs to not only be strong, but to be healthy. Because, see, strength is nothing if you ain't got health. And strength isn't just the capacity to inflict harm on another person or to inflict damage onto another person. Strength is the capacity to heal yourself, to do spiritual work, to sculpt your body, to be disciplined in action and act, in knowledge and thought, in processing information. Strength is all those things. But they work constantly to destroy that which could make us stronger and make us whole. Now, I know many Republicans, many conservatives are going to find fault with that. But it is so evident that very few people deny it anymore. This is why I call them nihilists. Because they are. That is what they are. That is what they do. And yet, we keep having conversations about what these folks are. It was not up to the Democratic Party to once again save them. It wasn't. The Democratic Party has, in the last 20 years, multiple times, tried to help save the Republicans from themselves. And over the past 10, 12 years specifically, the Republican Party has literally been on a, what we might call a war's path, undoing all of the things that the Democratic Party has done to try to undo the harm that the Republicans have put into place. Harm that negatively impacts working people, working families, family cohesiveness, ability of families to be able to live comfortably, communities' ability to support those family units, a community's ability to heal those family units, to heal individuals within that family. They have literally worked to undo legislation, regulations, policies that benefit the people who they say they work for the most, families. They are pro-life and pro-family. Their policies are neither of those things. Neither of those things. Their policies are not pro-life. Life does not end when you exit the vagina. Some might say life actually begins. Not to say that a child isn't alive. Being alive and living, alive and engaged in life, is two very different things. A person can be alive, but a person is engaging in life when they're upright, or they are up, they're alert, they're developing, they're maturing. That's life. Being pro-family isn't just a nod to having children, which brings us back to the whole pro-life thing. But being pro-family is wanting good paying jobs, wanting to develop people so that they can not only have those jobs, but maybe create those jobs. Giving mom an opportunity to decide if she's ready to be a mother or not, and then giving her the capacity to deal with being a mother. Giving the family the capacity to deal with troubles that are outside the expertise of the family. Most people, though they may want to think they're good with psychology, aren't. All of these things are necessary when you're talking about creating a pro-life and pro-family environment. And these folks have literally been working for the last 30 years, more than that if you count Reagan, to make pro-life, pro-family choices within the economy, within the society, within culture, harder and harder and harder and harder. Being anti-LGBTQ is not being pro-family or pro-life. It's being pro-bigot. Blocking CRT and going after, quote, wokeism, which is just going after black people, is not demonstrating cultural awareness. It is demonstrating cultural bigotry. But I may be too close to the subject to accurately see what is happening, as I was once told. But I digress. The destruction of the speakership. First and foremost, and it's so funny because I almost recorded an episode on this in January. The inability of the Republican Party to pick a speaker immediately after taking the majority of the House early on this year. I'm recording this on October the 5th, 2023. That inability spoke to the problems of governing that they were going to have. The destruction of McCarthy's speakership, the removal of him from that position, is a reminder, of the incapacity of Republicans to appoint leaders into positions in a way that would keep the Republicans viable presently and sustainable into the future. They are going to, in other words, try to eat themselves alive. And they are going to do that because you have a bunch of folks who are not interested in governing. Nor are they interested in doing the hard work of legislating. They are there for one reason and one reason only: to play. Isn't it something? The Republican Party did not have control of the House of Representatives for 40 years. Then they took it over. And look at what the House of Representatives has become in the last 30 years since they had actually become a viable party within that chamber. Nobody really speaks about that. I want you to really think about where the discourse of politics has gone since big corporations has helped the Republican Party become a viable political apparatus by forcing American citizens to constantly listen to sledge Sludge. Excuse me, not sledge. Sludge. Masquerading as independent news. Though it is really corporatist, conservative propaganda. Think about where this country is with its political discourse, since they have made the Republican Party a viable political apparatus at a period of time when they are, what's the word I'm looking for? Void of real political solutions. And here, I'm literally talking about going all the way back to Reagan's tenure. Because even though they had policy ideas, these policy ideas were not good ideas. They were actually terrible ideas that had been tried. The goal was always to turn back the clock. Always. To go back to the pre-progressive era where corporations ruled and government was inept. Think about where we've come from and where we've come to. 43 years ago. Yes, inflation was problematic, but here's what was funny about it. The arguments that were being had among economists in the 1970s was, one, where was the inflation coming from? And most of them understood where it was coming from. And two, how much price control power does the federal government have, and how much could it therefore use to get inflation under control? Reagan was of the mind that the federal government had little price control power other than tweaking knobs and levers within the economy, thus, you know, tax cuts and things like that. Whereas Jimmy Carter somewhat believed the same thing, yet also somewhat believed that the federal government had a lot more power than it was using to control those prices. We went from talking about what good the government do in the everyday lives of people to a president who saw the federal government as an enemy to the American people. Yet, I will acknowledge, and I think it was Lawrence O'Donnell who talked about this on his show, Reagan may have not always acted as if he saw it the same way that he said he saw it. But that's what it is. Fast forward from Reagan to Gingrich. Gingrich was a true believer of what type of vision he had for the government. The government was the enemy of the people and needed to be cut down to size. Now, mind you, the real threats to civil liberties was not his aim. That wasn't his aim. It wasn't the law enforcement mechanisms of the federal government that he was after, till presently. Those things that had become unmanageable in the 1960s, 50s, and into the 70s. It was those aspects of government that impacted big corporations that he was after. And so, in the 90s, discord transformed drastically to government is an enemy and must be tamed. This flowed into the 2000s until 2008, and then suddenly it was, oh, government's the enemy, but we need welfare. Screw everyday Americans. We need welfare because we were stupid. We were criminal. We were derelict of duty. And so government, give us. You still suck, but give us money and we love you. Okay, now we got the money. You're horrible and we're going to fund people who want to destroy you. Which is seldom talked about. All of these businesses that were bailed out from 2008 to 2012, a lot of those same businesses had no problem hiring lobbying firms with the money that they were bailed out with, by the way, hiring lobbying firms to push legislation that was going to further deregulate them and allow them to enhance their criminality. No problem with any of that. We went from the government can do some good things to, well, where we're at today. Where we are at today. Think about that transformation. 45 years ago, we were talking about the good government can do in everyday life. Today, the news media constantly tells you government should be destroyed because it is a destructive instrument. It does no good for you. At the same time, the news media acknowledges that big business, big corporations are spending billions a year to lobby the government. Why is government the answer for big business, but the government is not an answer for your problems? Something I want you to think about. We are seeing the reality of a zombie party and what that zombie party really, really means for the health and well-being of this country. The question I have for all of y'all, and I'm about to move on to another topic here, is do you really understand the danger that is presented in the crumbling of this political leg? Because unless something drastic happens, the Republican Party is only going to become more extreme. Unless something drastic happens, they are only going to become more extreme. It's a self-feeding loop that they are now stuck in. You cannot be a liberal or progressive Republican and expect to be elected, nor to be taken seriously. Every member of this Republican Party, with maybe a few who keep their heads down, with an exception of maybe a few who keep their heads down, but the majority of the Republican Party caucus aren't good people. And I don't say that lightly. I say it because they literally have made people who look like me a talking point to score points with their base, who I used to argue were misunderstood and were not racist at all. I used to argue that on this podcast. We need to look at them from the standpoint of economics because economics, yada, yada, yada. You can go back. Even with January 6th, the episodes that I did with January 6th, or on January 6th, should I say, I was still arguing we need to look at this through an economic lens. And then they started scoring points off of people who look like me based on CRT and woke. And they went hard in the paint with those talking points. And they were able to take back the Congress, the House of Representatives, particularly based on those talking points. I can't say it's not about race anymore. Can't do it. But I digress. What if the Democrats had saved McCarthy's speakership? What would the result had really been? Would the Democrats had received any type of credit for doing that? Would the mainstream media have said anything positive about the Democratic Party deciding to save McCarthy's seat or his head from rolling off of the speaker's chair? Which, I apologize, I probably shouldn't say that considering the craziness of some of their followers. But truthfully, what would have been gained if they had done it? What would have been gained if they had done it? I'm waiting. Anybody know? Would the mainstream media have given him any credit? I don't think so. But maybe I'd be wrong. Maybe the mainstream media would have said, you know, in a show of just fabulous bipartisanship, the Democratic Party decided to vote to keep McCarthy in his chair as speaker. Maybe they would have said it. But I want to actually put an asterisk next to that. Because with all of the articles, the lamentations that have come out painting the Democrats as the primary reason why he was kicked out of the speaker's chair, I suppose they would have probably found some way to disparage the Democrats. Probably they would have said, well, McCarthy wouldn't have been in this situation if the Democrats hadn't dot, 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 dot. As I keep telling y'all, the system ain't broke, y'all. It's operating exactly how it's supposed to operate. GOPTV, that memo from Roger Ailes, is the playbook that all of these corporate media entities are operating from. None of them want to be seen as too liberal. All of them want to be seen as conservative, and not only conservative, but pro-corporation conservative, pro-fascist conservative. And so the Democratic Party only gets credit when they too are being accomplices to fascism, into corporate autocracy, into the corporate takeover of government. That's when they get credit. Outside of that, no credit for them. Which brings me to the conclusion of today's show. Now, really, one more topic, and then I'm going to be signing off. Something I have been wondering, watching all this unfold. The Heritage Foundation actually was a consortium. It wasn't just the Heritage Foundation, but a consortium of conservative foundations and groups and individuals, power players, really, within the conservative movement, released this tome titled Project 2025. It's a playbook for an incoming conservative fascist administration for 2025. Watching all this occur, I've been wondering, does this in any way hamper the planning for 2025? Because even though now it seems predictable that McCarthy wasn't going to last as Speaker until the end of the term, I highly doubt anybody saw his removal or his leaving the post ending the way that it did. Now, look, conservatives, for as many problems as they have, especially neoconservatives, the one thing that they are really good at doing is adjusting to new realities. And so, it wouldn't surprise me if this whole thing doesn't actually interrupt 2025, the Project 2025 planning. But I really honestly believe that the Republican Party, with this action, may have not only guaranteed that they are going to lose the House of Representatives, because I think that was kind of a bygone conclusion. A lot of people had suspected that the Republicans were going to lose the House of Representatives. Most agreed that it was likely going to be a five to ten seat margin that the Democrats would enjoy. But I actually think, thanks to this and their efforts to not only overturn Roe v. Wade nationwide, but also to target black communities and to target black culture the way that they are doing, I think, and target Latinos and LGBTQ, I really think that they've just guaranteed a sufficiently larger Democratic caucus than the Democrats would have enjoyed if all of these things had not been done. Further, and this is going to be really interesting to watch a year from now, I think the Republicans' attempt, success in overturning Roe v. Wade already made running for Senate in a lot of states difficult for Republicans. But this, when combined with the previous 12 years worth of Republican records, may have guaranteed that the Republicans will not control a single branch of government after the elections in 2024. Which brings me to this point. They are dangerous because they know what I know. They know what I know, which is what I just laid out for you. And they know that if they lose both chambers after with the 2024 elections, they know it is unlikely that they are ever going to gain both back again, let alone one. It becomes increasingly impossible for them to gain back at least the House of Representatives after 2026. After 2026. Gaining back the Senate is possible. But because of this knowledge, and I want to say big up to Dr. Carr for saying what I've been thinking, they literally might blow up the Constitution to ensure that they have a greater say in government because they cannot legitimately win elections constitutionally. You may want to say this is insane. You may want to say that's crazy. You may want to say a lot of things. Tom Hartman is one of the few people in media that I have heard talk about this plan that these corporations have been working slowly and deliberately to implement over the past decade, 2 decades, 3 decades maybe, to call for a new constitutional convention. All they need is a certain number of states to do to not ratify, but pass legislation saying we need a new constitutional convention, and it'll happen. And they've been working towards that steadily, and they've gotten more states than you know to say, yes, we need one. We are really entering a time that could be very, very altering to the course of history in this country. Pay attention. Pay attention closely and engage. You want to stop these people? You're going to have to make them irrelevant at the ballot box. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I'm your brother, Vladimir Deese Ogaya. Find me on radio, the number 4ALL, radio, the number 4ALL.net. Don't forget it's .net, not .com. Radioforall.net. Hook me up on PayPal, Cash App, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, PayPal, Cash App, $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you can do. Help me keep this thing rolling and going. If you want to reach out to me, you could do so through radioforall.net. Just click into one of my many episodes there. Make sure it's the newer ones. If you go back beyond 2015, do not hit contact contributor because those are all on a different email address, and I won't get it. So, but on the newer ones, I will. You can also reach me on Facebook, Class War Battlefield Podcast. Soon, I will be launching a YouTube channel dedicated wholly to Class War Battlefield Podcast. You can also send a message to me at CWB Podcast Main at gmail.com. Well, I think that's it. Oh, big up to Dr. Obatashaka. Big up to Dr. Obatashaka. Professional Left Podcast. One of my favorites. One of the ones most of y'all ain't listening to. You should. Very, 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 very fun. You know, Roland Martin and all them, Black Power Media, Dr. Karen Hunter, Dr. Greg Carr, you know, all the family. Best of the Left Podcasts, Sam Cedar, Majority Report, Emma Vigeland, The Young Turks, all of y'all. Again, I'll see y'all in the next one. I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. I'm your brother, Vladimir Deese Ogaya. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.